If you're wondering which session you're in, this is a town hall discussion about the future of the Comprehensive STD Prevention Services Grant. For those of you who may not know, our five-year competitive grant is up for renewal, meaning the grant needs to be written in 2013 with a start date of January 2014. So I'm very interested in getting input into how this grant should look, given everything that's going on in our changing healthcare and public health environment, and certainly need your input. So Peter Leone, who is chair of NCSD, is going to moderate the session. I'm going to start with just some introductory comments that I've made to NCSD at their annual meeting. I've made it to the NCSD through their board meetings. But I want to have the opportunity to at least share thoughts that I have. These are not decisions. These are just ideas. And I really need input from the field and partners as to the direction everyone thinks we need to go. Because at the moment, at least 60% of our budget at CDC goes out to state and local programs. And we have other things that go out to state and local programs, like our SUNS surveillance grant, our training centers, and other things. But at least core-based funding is a significant amount of money, and as I think you've been hearing in sessions, we really need to show that we have a good return on our investment so that we don't end up with having significant reductions in future years. We've been very lucky to be able to stay the course. We were trying an index card method where people could write questions on index cards.
Yeah, in fact, there are more index cards in the back. So I know some people are shy about coming up to microphones and speaking, so we will hand out index cards, collect those. I'll try to sort through those and try to pick out highlights. So anytime you need a card, raise your hand, and we'll also take pledges for funding STD programs while we're at it.
Yes. So we want to really have this to be an interactive opportunity so that I can hear what the issues are at the state and local level and from other partners. So things that we're sort of thinking about as we start preparing for the next funding cycle is certainly having us sort of anticipate whatever healthcare system changes are going to be occurring and how can we take advantage of those things. So as you heard today in the plenary from Dr. Levy as well as Kevin Cranston, we anticipate increases in health insurance with a number of our vulnerable populations, especially young people and young men, actually having more access to health insurance than they previously had. And this was reviewed this morning that Medicaid, we anticipate, will increase to 133% of the poverty level, including adults and young men. Already young adults are covered on their health, their parents' health insurance up to the age of 26. You may not know they don't have to be living with their parents. They can be actually married and living somewhere else, and still they're eligible to remain on their parents' health insurance if their parents still have health insurance. And obviously there's going to be these new health insurance exchanges that we're going to need to understand and figure out how we can work in those areas as well. A lot of the services that are going to be provided through the changing healthcare environment includes no-cost sharing for clinical preventive services if you have an A or B rating by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, or these other HRSA types of documents that you heard about for adolescents and for women. So what they're talking about for adolescents is something called Bright Futures. That is a standard that the American Academy of Pediatrics is putting out of what children and adolescents should be receiving in terms of preventive services. And then there was a new IOM report on preventive services for women, and that's the HRSA's basis for the type of services. So obviously adolescents and women have gotten some additional support through HRSA's recommendations for beneficiaries and plans. We also need to be flexible when change is happening. I think we need to make sure that we're very nimble. I think maybe one of the things that we learned in the last funding cycle, I think at the beginning of the funding cycle, we thought maybe we were being nimble in the way that we are providing a syphilis elimination formulation support. But over time, as we ended up with way too many high morbidity areas, which were getting a lot of the base funding, we actually found that we were actually taking money away from the epidemic. And so that was the reason, if you don't know, why I sort of suspended the formula for the last 2 years of the FOA, because I felt like it was not helping us in really getting the money going where it is, and we're just staying the course with syphilis elimination funding. Everyone's getting the same amount, you know, that they got last year and they'll get next year, and then we need to move forward. So this is an example of when we're thinking about this, we have to try to be prescient so we can try to figure out where do we want to be 5 years, you know, where do we want to be in 2019, and make sure that we're creating an FOA announcement that's flexible enough to meet sort of these changing needs. Certainly we're going to need to be looking at how we identify and address prevention gaps and the safety net that we need to be defining and providing safety net services. We certainly need to maintain our core STD functions, and I'll talk a little bit about that. And as I said, we need to maintain the safety net for people who remain uninsured or for those who are actually insured who choose not to access the general health care delivery system like we heard about because of confidentiality concerns or other reasons that they would prefer to be seen in another clinical setting for for those problems. There's a lot of, I've learned a lot about differences between authorizing language and appropriations. And so I just want to sort of, for those of you who are not familiar with our different authorizing language, is that our overarching public health service authorization is called 318. And this actually gives us very broad authority to use our federal dollars for training and technical assistance. There's even a section where we could use some of these dollars for research, demonstration, public information, education projects. Part of the authorization is this money needs to go to states to do surveillance, screening and follow-up, case finding, demonstration projects to test or evaluate prevention and control strategies. So this is actually the word out of our authorizing language. It allows us to award these funds for grants that are innovative, interdisciplinary approaches. And the other important thing to recognize about 318 authorization is if you use 318 funds, you are eligible for the 340B program, which means you're eligible for this sort of discounted federal drug program, which is certainly of interest to a lot of public clinics, both STD clinics and our family planning partners. Now, there's been our infertility prevention program, when it was authorized back in the early 90s, with the appropriation for infertility prevention funds also came special authorizing language that had to be used, which was called 318A. And this language has a lot of very specific information. We don't have a lot of flexibility under 318A. Basically, you have to use 80% of your funds for service delivery, be that screening, treatment, and referral, or outreach. And it actually prohibits hiring any disease investigation staff off of those funds. So this is obviously a very specialized program that was needed at the time infertility prevention projects were started. But over time, interestingly, this authorization has actually sunsetted a little bit, and the appropriation line item no longer exists. We just get one appropriation line item for STD funding. And it's up to us at CDC to decide how much of that money do we want to put into a 318 authorization or a 318A authorization. So we have flexibility here of having our resources used in different ways. And there was also some limits on providing fees for service. And obviously you've been hearing a lot about how we want to be doing more billing. So the goal of this session is, and this is a conversation we're going to be having for the next, I believe, about 5 months, because at that point CDC really needs to start writing the FOA, is I'm very interested in getting input from the field as to how you feel this FOA should look. And sort of the process that I'm using for input, I mentioned that I've already been discussing this with NCSD, and certainly Bill Smith is here, and I know that NCSD is very interested in this FOA because of its membership, and certainly I'm sure NCSD will be collating input and formally providing input to us at CDC about this FOA. But I'm also just hearing other thoughts from state and local programs and other partners. So obviously we're having this town hall today at the national conference. We are having regional IPP meetings. Unfortunately, I was ambitious and thought maybe I could attend these meetings and get input, but Bill and Steve Shapiro have been attending these meetings to get input from both state STD directors and family planning directors at those regional meetings, so we're looking forward to the input that's collected there. There's been some webinars I've been having, and I'm willing to have more webinars about this if people feel that there is interest to have further discussion. The webinars that we like to use, there's a little chat page, so as we're discussing, people can be asking questions and we can be providing answers. I'm also planning on having a more formal consultation, a two-day meeting that is actually scheduled for May 31st and June 1st that will be a diverse group of partners, because there are a lot of people interested in STD prevention besides STD prevention directors. We've got a lot of partners out there, so we need to hear from our managed care partners, our federally qualified health centers, our training centers, our family planning partners, what do they think STD prevention should look like in 2014, and how should we be utilizing our money. So that meeting certainly will have robust representation from state and local programs, but it's going to be a diverse group where we can actually sit down and have some discussions. We've also created an email box. For those of you who want to just send in your suggestions, so I encourage you to do that. We will be taking suggestions up until August 31st of this year, and at that point, we really need to sit down and get this FOA written, because if we don't get it written, you guys aren't going to get it out in a time to respond in a timely fashion. If you have other ideas, write them on your cards of how I could be receiving input. So there's a number of goals that I've come up with for the grants and some ideas that I've had. Some of these I've already bounced off NCSD. A couple have been completely rejected, so we're not going to try that unless some other people have some ideas. But let me just – I'm not so good on the animation. I'm just going to go through sort of thoughts that I've had. And I have to say, some of this is based on having spent 22 years writing the CSPS grant for CDC. So now that I'm at CDC and I'm on the receiving end, I'm hoping that I can, some of the things that I was unhappy about, I might be able to change. So first of all, we do not want programs spending 2 months out of their 12-month period writing a grant for CDC. That is too much money taken away from service delivery. So we want to streamline the grant. We want to have a page limit, because also if we get these 100-page single-spaced documents coming back to CDC, that's a lot of work at our end to read the grants to figure out what you're doing. So we really want to have something that's a streamlined, limited page limit. And the question that I've been asking in the field, because there's all these different chapters now. You have to write a CSPS part, you have to write an IPP part, you write a civil elimination part, and those who write GIST have to write a GIST part. You know, is it time for us to say, we're just going to do one STD program prevention grant? You have to send your input, because there are other people that don't agree with this, weigh in to what you like. And that allows programs to really put forward the plan that they want to have for their state. And the other thing that I would like to recommend people doing now, and I know this can be a challenge because I don't want you doing a lot of work and then having to do something totally different when the FOA comes out, but I truly believe that every STD program needs a local program plan, and that you really need to be serving your local area for your needs, and that our funding should come along and help support your plan in general. You know, our plan should not be something totally separate from what is going on at the state and local level. So I'm really encouraging people to be thinking about a planning phase this year while we're writing the FOA, so that when the FOA comes out, you've already done a lot of your work, and you can just put your plan into the grant and submit it. We are going to be offering some training for people that have not had a lot of experience in program planning and evaluation, and how to write, grants that have objectives and methods and evaluations and outcomes. I am committed to make sure that this FOA is published 3 months before the due date. I realize a lot of you have at least a month of bureaucracy that the grant goes into that you have no control over, and so that will at least give everybody 2 months. Although I don't want you spending your whole 2 months writing the grant, I'm hoping that a lot of it would be in place ahead of time. I'm also proposing that we not try to get first 6 months of data, which is never available. It's very crude. Use your annual plan from last year for your data that you will support your current plan, so that we're not going to be rushing around and collecting a lot of preliminary data for the first 3 months of the year. Take your annual plan from the previous year and use that to inform the basis of your program planning efforts. The other thing that I'm looking at is, how do we kind of write this grant in a way that it can be flexible enough that it meets the needs of all the diverse states that we have in the United States. So clearly I'm looking at sort of overarching kinds of themes that we're talking about in public health. What are you doing in the area of assessment? What are you doing in the area of assurance? What are you doing in the area of policy? Notice I'm not being that disease specific. Some people may be having more chlamydia work they need to do than other. Other parts of the country may have some syphilis priorities. I'm hoping everyone's going to start relooking at what you're doing around gonorrhea, which we have not really prioritized, specifically for many years. Then we have activities. And if you actually look at these activities, they're structured a lot like the HIV prevention grant, sort of the pillars of what are we doing. We screen. We test and link to care. We do partner services and other interventions, and we do health promotion and condom distribution. So I'm also trying to find some similarities. So for those of you who also have to write your HIV prevention grant, so I'm looking carefully at the HIV prevention FOA, and I encourage you, all of you who don't have HIV under you, to look at that FOA. How can we find some themes and similarities so it's easier for those combined programs to be writing, sort of a more cohesive, integrated plan if that works? And then certainly the priorities that we're working on, at least right now, and we'll be seeing the direction we're going in, is really trying to take more population-based approaches, focusing on where the burden of infection is, a more holistic approach in the area of sexual health, social determinants of health, looking at the perspective from an adolescence, which encompasses a lot of different STDs, including we could be looking at herpes and HPV and other issues, not just the IPP, GC, and chlamydia only. Certainly, we've got to find some new ways that we approach burden of STDs among men who have sex with men. And clearly, I hope the resistant gonorrhea problem may be not as bad in a few years, but at the rate we're getting new drugs and the rate our surveillance is indicating strains are sort of increasing or having decreased susceptibility, that's certainly a priority. And then one of our global priorities is elimination of congenital syphilis. And I think that the reason to focus on that is, first of all, I truly believe that having a baby with congenital syphilis in this country, with all of our health care that we have, is a sentinel event. It's a failure of our health care delivery system, and it's a failure of public health. And we really should work towards eliminating congenital syphilis. And that can back end into the work that we do around heterosexual transmission of syphilis and the success that we've really seen in our syphilis elimination tools in the heterosexual epidemics, where we haven't been as successful in the gay men or other men having sex with men epidemics. And so we've got to look for different strategies with gay men, but certainly I encourage us to continue with the important successes we've had with reducing our rates of heterosexual syphilis in the country, which obviously will reduce our rates of congenital syphilis. Our center director, Dr. Fenton, who's here, also has a number of cross-cutting issues that we need to be paying attention to. These themes could be, incorporated into your screening programs, but, how are we connecting with the new healthcare delivery system? What are we doing with prevention through healthcare? How are we working in the area of program collaboration and service integration? How are we doing with our health equity issues and addressing our health equity issues and social determinants of health, as well as what kinds of sexual health efforts are we making to provide a more holistic wellness approach to the work that we do in the field? My funding principles that I've been throwing out, again, interested in input, is, first of all, I truly believe that STDs are the foundation of everything that we do in our center. Everybody is sexually active in this country eventually, I believe, and that we really should have the core foundation of the house. So I don't see us ever getting to the point where we're ever going to say, well, some states don't need STD funding because you have a population that's sexually active, which means they're potentially at risk of sexually transmitted infections. So I'm looking at some base funding for us in the United States. One of the things I proposed to NCSD is that we would have kind of what I call low population states, medium population states, and high population states. And that's how we would have three different tiers of base funding based on population. It says nothing about morbidity or any other factors. So everyone has like a core base amount of money that they get. Then above the base, we're thinking about, trying to look at, and I don't know if we're that out of whack, but we're trying to look at, instead of this historical way we funded STDs for as long as I've been alive, which is you basically got the same amount of money you got the last year, and that's the way it went, is we try to look at distributing the money above the base, in a way that is, based on kind of need. Now, how do we define need? Well, if we count cases, that rewards people who are doing good screening. If we, so we're really looking, and this is where I need input from you, because I know there's been a lot of discussion around the HIV formula, there's been a lot of discussion around TB formulas, hepatitis has been having discussion about formulas. I think clearly everyone recognizes we need to make sure that we're funding based on need, but how should we look at that? And I'm willing to look at formulas that look at social determinants of health, and so we're, you know, at CDC going to be looking at a lot of different formulas, and again, I really need input, and you can email us your formulas you think would be really something that we should be considering. So certainly we have not made any decisions about the approach that we're taking. I think my general feeling is, you know, it's hard to write grants every 3 years. I'm a little nervous. We're in a period of great fluidity and great change. And so my problem is I would like to do a 5-year grant, but with that we've got to make sure we're building in the flexibility and allowing us to be nimble so that we can respond to the changes. I've clearly heard loud and clear that, you know, don't do things quickly. It's hard to respond at the state and local level. We need to be able to know the change is coming so we can anticipate it and we can be prepared for it. And certainly I think you guys know a lot more about change with all the cuts that you've had to deal with in the last 5 years, and really had to, you know, to deal with a lot of that already. So certainly we want to do the least amount of harm if we're looking at kind of a little bit of a change in our need-based funding. Then the other thing, though, is that I think we also really want to reward excellence. You've heard that we've got to be able to show our business case, you know, for why we need funding. And we don't have a lot of evidence. We've been doing a lot of things for a long time. Everyone says, yeah, we should just keep doing it. And I ask, why? And I'm not getting a lot of data. So I think we've got to be really critical of what we're doing, really test our hypothesis. This is probably great 20 years ago, but do we still need to do this now? Is there a different way that we can do business that's a better investment? And with that, we need to reward innovation and excellence. And the challenge is we're not like TB, who actually the TB formula, I believe, that they're looking at is not only morbidity of cases, but percent of cases that complete treatment. So they've actually got a performance measure that they're using in a way that they may be distributing their money. I don't think we know yet what our best performance measures are that we should be using in that. But I do think that we can't just be putting money out sort of based on need. We really, because sometimes, you know, needy areas also may not be able to spend their money as well as other areas. So we've also got to have some of our money be used for sort of innovative projects that can help advance our programmatic field to make sure that we've got the most science-based, cost-effective interventions out there. I had thrown out an idea similar to what HIV did, was sort of having a C application for innovation, and that's what was completely shot down by NCSD. So I'm not planning on having a separate, you know, pot of money that goes out where you can apply for innovative demonstration projects. I'm trying to be creative to figure out how can we incorporate that into our base, you know, allocation so everybody can apply for that, because also innovation is very different in different parts of the country. Something that might be innovative for one area may already be routine, you know, standard of practice in a different area. So we need to kind of recognize the diversity and see how we can have some level of support of innovation and quality and evidence-based interventions. Some other principles that I have is, even though some of you were very happy to hear that I did not require you to do our performance measures for the next 2 years, it's not that I'm not interested in performance measures. We've been measuring things at CDC a certain way for 10 years. The point of having performance metrics is to improve program, and we really hadn't seen a correlation with our performance measures, which really weren't changing, and program improvement. So either we were not measuring the correct thing, or we had other problems. So we really need to have a good discussion over the next couple years, or at least the next year, and I really need your help, of what we think are those values that we want to be putting forward to say, I'm measuring this, this is why my program is good, and we can go to our funders and say, I can show this outcome because of the work that we're doing. I do know there's two performance measures that I think we're going to need to be doing, and this gets into the need for us to be working closely with HIV prevention. We need to know how many new HIV infections are identified in STD clinics across the country right now. And we do get money from DHAP that goes out we get $10 million from DHAP that goes out to your program grants. So we really need to be showing, if all the STD clinics close, how that's going to impact on the ability to identify in a very cost-efficient way new HIV infections. We also need to know how many HIV infections we're identifying through our STD contact tracing programs, especially with our syphilis cases. We identify a lot of new HIV infections because there's a lot of co-infection. and a lot of partners may not know their status or haven't been tested recently. If for some reason we're not doing as much syphilis contact tracing, how is that going to impact on the ability to find new HIV infections? So those are some metrics that I know our colleagues in DHAP are very interested in hearing from us. So those are some examples of important metrics. We need to figure out what are the important metrics we need in our area of STD. We're complicated. We've got lots of different diseases, but that's something that's important. So we are going to need to be measuring things. We just need to figure out which are the most important measures that have the highest impact to evaluate our programs. And I said we need to be nimble and flexible. I just had a few other comments, and this isn't really related to the CSPS, but just in case there's questions. Some of you may know that I've done a little bit of a realignment in the division at CDC. I'm doing it to build better teams and interdisciplinary approaches to the way we work at CDC, and I'm also doing it in hopes that we'll better serve you in terms of technical assistance and capacity building at the state and local level. We're in a sort of a process of phasing in this realignment because I have a number of branch chief positions that are currently vacant, and I need to get those positions in place before we can officially realign. But as of Monday, we are doing sort of a soft launch of two branches, and we are sort of dissolving the former program and training branch, PTB, and have created actually two branches because we found this one big branch was having trouble with all of the responsibilities that was given to that branch. So there's going to be a branch called the Program Development and Quality Improvement Branch, PDQ, and Dr. Roxanne Barrow has graciously agreed to be acting until I fill that position. And this branch is going to be a hybrid of sort of scientists, technical assistants, and programs. So there's three units. There's going to be, we're merging the guidelines and training together into a guidelines technical assistance training unit, which will be doing more guidelines than just the treatment guidelines. We'll have more staff in that unit. We certainly know that there's been a request to have more specific guidelines on how we should screen for MSM. We would like to get some evidence-based guidelines around EPT so that the U.S. Preventive Services can give that an A or B rating in the prevention portfolio that they look at. And we also want the unit to be developing more tools and other things that can be available to you to help improve practice in your program and among your providers in your community. Then there's going to be a unit that's very small at the moment, but a program innovation and development unit, which will be helping translating science into best practices out at the state and local level and helping share best practices between programs. Certainly I know NCSD has been very helpful to us in the peer-to-peer type of work and the best practice sharing. We want to support that more and work more in that area. And then we're kind of changing our program consultant project officer type of approach. CDC is actually having a lot of discussions with the Office of State, Local, Territorial, and Tribal unit on, you know, how project officers serve state and local health department. There's a big discussion about what's a project officer and what's a program consultant and what's the difference. So I kind of decided not to wait for CDC to figure out these definitions. I've come up with my own until we know what CDC wants us to do. So we're going to be using the term program coordinator. We've actually divided the country up into four areas, and these program coordinators will be responsible not only for the states in their area, but they'll also be responsible for sort of regional coordination and looking at regional problems, regional solutions, regional best practices. So hopefully we can build capacity not on a state-by-state basis with random distribution of people around the country, but also collectively within regional areas. And we're hoping that this will better serve you. And then the second branch is actually our field services branch, which is all of our staff that are out in the field. In the past, it used to be the program consultant had to not only supervise all the federal staff in the field, which we've got about 130, they also had to manage all the state technical assistance and other things, and it was just in all the PGO problems. So it was really too much for I think any human that I know to do. So the program coordinators really are involved in coordination, technical assistance, capacity building for you. The field staff are still going to be based in the field, and they're going to be working at the state and local level based on the needs of what you have for your programs. I don't know if we have a map of that. This is actually just showing you who your new program coordinators are. Sorry, getting behind. Yeah, no, I'm going back. Sorry. Anyway, I wanted to give the concept of the program coordinator. So for those of you who didn't get a chance to read my Dear Colleague letter that came out on Friday. You were probably getting ready for the conference. Right now, Steve Shapiro is going to be our interim program coordinator for the western part of the United States, which is basically regions 8, 9, and 10. Vicki Bozeman Holmes is going to be our program coordinator for the Midwest, and we added, okay, you can write. You don't get to give input on this. This is a decision that we've made. So if things aren't working, you're not getting the technical assistance you need, then let us know. And the one change that we made, because the Midwest kind of had not quite as many states, we added Kentucky and West Virginia into the Midwestern part. So that's the only place where we're deviating from our HSS regions. Sheldon Black is going to be handling our regions in the South, 4 and 6. And then Dane Collins at the moment is interim for the Northeast. And Lori Anderson, who is moving to Atlanta to take opportunities with us at CDC, is also going to be the interim Northeast coordinator until we get some of these positions filled. So you've got your program coordinator, and that's who you contact. If you have any questions, contact your program coordinator. But what they're going to be doing is they're also going to be triaging requests. If you've got like an IT problem, we're going to figure out how to get your IT needs met. If you've got a surveillance problem, then that's going to go to Hillard Weinstock and the surveillance group, and they will provide technical assistance in the area of surveillance. If you've got a health services research question, or if you need some modeling done, that's going to go to our health services research branch, and our health economists and our program evaluation specialists will be available to provide technical assistance. So we're looking kind of at across all the divisions so that we can provide you better technical assistance for the needs in your area. Then we also have our business officials, and they're actually going to be in our administrative unit, and they're really going to be handling all those detailed PGO kinds of issues that come up. Now, they're not the ones that you call when you got a fiscal question, because it's first got to go to the program coordinator so they can look programmatically and say, yeah, that makes sense. I approve this kind of money. But then when we have to go through the PGO process to do a lot of the work to implement these grants and changes, our business officials, and we have two of them, Shane is going to be in the West and the Midwest, and David Byram in the South and Northeast, they'll be your sort of advocates to get things through the PGO system. We had too many people calling PGO with all of our different program consultants, and PGO is challenged by a number of resource limitations and positions that are vacant. And so we wanted to also streamline our connections with them so that we can make it easier for them to be responding to our requests. So that's the program coordination. Then, as I said, the field services branch is a separate branch now. And these are, some of you may have never seen the distribution of federal staff that we have out in the field. And as you can see, we kind of have the haves and the haves not, because we've got a big part of the country that doesn't have any DA staff. You know, they don't have the luxury of having extra staff by CDC. So we've divided this up using our 14 field staff out in the field as well as one at headquarters, and again have a regional basis for supervision of federal staff. Now, what I want people to understand is this is only for purposes of federal supervision, because there's certain requirements that we have to do in terms of performance evaluations. There's certain requirements that we have in terms of training and workforce development that we really, really need to be paying attention to. They are not going to be supervising day-to-day program activities. That's your responsibility of if they're in your area to be giving them the assignments that are appropriate for them at your state and local level. Certainly, we're going to work with you on developing that workforce plan so that we have a good plan in place that meets the need of state and local health departments. So there's a little bit of shift that our people in the field are really going to be working for state and local programs in the areas that you feel like you need them most. And it's not really going to be CDC directing what their activities are locally. They really are out in the field to help you. And, you know, with the formula, we're going to kind of be looking at how we can improve distribution of our field staff so that it's not concentrated in certain parts of the country that we sort of have a more broader geographic distribution. But that's going to take time. I'm not planning on moving staff right now just for the sake of moving. So we want to kind of look with attrition over time how we can make sort of this field staff distribution a little bit more equitable across the country. So, with the introduction, I guess we're going to now open up to index card questions and other comments that people would like to make at the microphone. But we're going to start with
I'm going to loosen my tie first so we can really get to work. So a couple of ground rules. There's mics, so if you have a question, stand up and walk to the mic because it's really hard to hear in the room. There are cards, so if you've filled out a card already, just hold it up. Someone will bring it up here, and I'll try to read those or summarize them. And if you've got more questions that come up and you're mic shy, just raise your hand. We'll give you a card. And I am representing myself. So I am the board chair for NCSD, but I'm the go-between. So I'm representing myself and my family at this point, which means that I will cut you off so we can get more people asking questions. So I have one that already had here. And I do want to add while we're getting these, I've always appreciated Gail, but I've gained even more respect for Gail because she actually does listen to the feedback. And, you know, we can have some pretty blunt discussions at times, I think, but this is an iterative process, and I appreciate the fact that she's been so open to provide the time here. She has had monthly discussions with the NCSD boards. I think they have more questions or discussions, we can help facilitate that as well, but she's been readily accessible in a time with a lot of change, and I just want to say I really appreciate that leadership, and I don't think people should take it lightly. So let me put up the first question, and it comes back to someone had written the question about the funding formula, and they wrote about disease rate, morbidity, state size, and I would add one more thing in there. From my perspective, urban-rural things are frequently not taken into consideration, and in a state like North Carolina where we have large rural areas, it's actually more expensive to provide care because there's transportation costs that frequently aren't written in any formula. So, I think there may be a chance to reiterate how that's moving. Yeah.
So we don't have a formula yet. That's where we want to get input. And I think we want to, you know, get input in what people think we should take into consideration of how we come up with, you know, some kind of equitable formula based on need. That's our goal, based on need. And obviously we've got, you know, we can look at other formulas. I don't know. TB is creating a formula. I don't know if that's official yet of how they're doing their formulas. HIV certainly, you know, had a formula. And again, we just want to look at different options and see, you know, what the distribution would be. I think, you know, so we're really seeking input. I think formulas are challenging, and I know that, you know, everyone is, you know, very worried about their money and already know that they've had a lot of reductions. So I'm sure this is of great concern to people. So I'm trying to do this in a way that is going to cause the least amount of harm out there, because I already know you guys are having a lot of, you know, challenging situations with just your local funding, you know, activities. And some programs no longer have any local funding. They just have their federal grant, and that's all the money they have for STD prevention. So that's where we just want input on, you know, and my other rule is I'd like to keep it simple. You know, when I was in California, we did some formula-based appropriations to our counties, and we had lots of fancy epidemiologists doing very sophisticated analysis for me, and in the end, it all kind of came down to some simple things. If you just looked at kind of morbidity and population-based, it kind of still came out sort of similar. So I think we want to also keep it very simple and something that will work for everyone.
So I'm going to try to alternate because there's people standing up asking questions at the mic with these, so we're not having people stand. So Kyle, go ahead.
Thanks. Gail, I just want to say thank you very much for this because I've learned a lot this afternoon already, and I appreciate you coming and talking to everybody. And now that I've buttered you up, I want to see if I can ask two questions. The first question/comment is, I was really glad to see that there's been an emphasis on program science presented at this conference, and I was wondering what your thoughts are in being able to better support program science work at the local jurisdiction, because right now it's really hard for us to do, because there's not really a line to pay for some of the things that need to get done for these program science activities to be rigorous and informative. And the second question that I have is more about CSPS. And I just would like to get some insight into what the difference is between a performance indicator or a performance measure and progress towards a grant objective. And those are my two questions.
Okay. Well, some of you may have not attended the program science meeting, and there's a real, I think, interest in closing the gap between program activities and scientific activities and more interaction between program and science so that we can help inform each other and have a better understanding of how we configure our programs to be the best combination of interventions with the highest impact at the population level. That roadmap is not totally clear of how that should be done. And I do feel that there's never going to be, resources that every state can have a health economist doing fancy modeling to figure out, how to best configure their programs. So I think it's going to need to be a combination of our scientists in the field, our scientists at CDC, some of the scientists that are in programs, as well as program people. So I do want to see how we can find a way with flexibility, because I think, states are at all different levels in terms of capacity, in terms of need, and how can we have that to be an option within the CSPS grant so that people can move program science forward. So I am interested in finding ways. It's similar to what Dr. Fenton has done with PCSI and is doing with prevention of healthcare. You're going to see language in every single grant that comes out of our center related to PCSI. What are you doing about program collaboration and service integration with your HIV partners, with your hepatitis partners, with your TB partners? And we might in STD also add on our reproductive health partners. So you're going to have to respond to that. That's not going to be an option anymore in grants. So I think we've got to carefully think about this program science and see what's appropriate, recognizing the diversity of the states at this time. Now, to be honest with you, I always had trouble figuring out what was the difference between the part I was writing in my grant that was my progress toward my objective, my performance indicators, and then the evidence-based action plans, and they all seem to sort of merge together into similar things and a lot of duplication. So, and that's why we're going to offer some training in program evaluation and in, and program planning. So I think we've got to figure out, first of all, at the state and local level, we need process objectives. You guys need some outcome objectives to know what the quality of your programs are, what your outcomes are, how much it's costing you. Do we need all that information at CDC? I'm not sure. I think we've got to look at what are the important things for you to be able to design, cost-effective quality programs in the work that you're doing and have benchmarks locally. Then we've got to have some national measures that are more impact measures that can say, this is what we're doing with our federal dollars. This is why we have cost-effective programs, and these are our outcomes that we're measuring. And so I think that I personally think we at the national level need more impact measures, ideally that, at the population level, but those are challenging. I don't think anyone's figured this out yet. And then I think we've got to have, obviously, state and locals helping us collect those data for what we need to be measuring at the national level. And then I think state and local programs also need to have more local measures so that they know that they're, having quality programs. And we probably don't have time, but I could talk about the prevalence monitoring program is an example of where we've recognized at the national level we're getting line-listed data from 7,000 clinics of test positivity, but because we don't know what the denominator is, we can't figure out what the data means. But I think prevalence monitoring is really critical at the local level, because how do you design a cost-effective screening program? So that's an example of where we can, look at things differently. And also we want to, work with locals who are struggling with what should I be measuring, how can I do quality improvement.
Okay. I've got a bunch of questions, so stay there, because I'm just going to – there's a couple of quick hitters. I'm going to try to see if we can quickly get answers to some of the things that are pretty straightforward. Someone said the applications due 5/31/13, so no applications over the summer for August 12. They want to know if they can plan to do something else over the summer. So,
August 12th of 2012 is when we will get input. So we're going to be writing this grant, in September and October. We need to get it into PGO by November so that they can get the announcement out by March. So yeah, the plan is, there's also so much that goes on at the end of the year at CDC with all this end of the year money and all these other grants that come out. So my goal is that we can let people take some summer vacations for a change. And that we will, that's our goal. I may be sitting over in PGO making sure they're meeting the deadline, but we're going to come up with some mutual agreements with PGO ahead of time, because a lot of people say, PGO is just going to delay it because they are under crisis management. They're only going to get to it when, it's really close to when the money needs to go out. But I think we've been working with them, and we have a good relationship with them, and I think that we can – this is our plan.
Another quick hitter here. Pacific Island jurisdictions want to know if the CSPS funding process timeline, is that not being held for them? And then in particular, with the FOA guideline to be issued this year in 2012.
Yeah, so the Pacific Islands, if you haven't heard, are going to be having a totally separate process. There's not going to be a separate CSPS grant for the Pacific Islands. They have one integrated HIV, STD, TB, and hepatitis grant. We're going to be having a meeting on Thursday. We'll talk about this more. I actually need some updates on my staff on what the timeline is for that process and what we're doing. But no, there will not. The Pacific Islands will not be applying for this CSPS grant that we're talking about here.
Hi, Jeff Stover in Virginia. Looking at the things that are going to be, you know, potentially part of the new CSPS, I didn't see anything in there about data management. So coming from a state who uses STDMIS and the comments that have been made, you know, starting, I guess, last summer about STDMIS is going away, I'm wondering at what point we're going to find out, you know, is there a replace, you know, are we going to go to patch something like NEDS? Will there be a NEDS module? Because we've tried that twice already, and both times it's kind of, you know, fluttered. So it's going to be important for those states who are STDMIS users to have some direction about where we know we need to be headed, because we're going to have to deal with that somehow in our funding.
Yeah. So this is a little separate from the CSPS grant. I did actually ask the question to NCSD, should we have a separate surveillance grant like HIV does and have a separate program grant? That also didn't go very far. So we certainly feel that, as you've heard from many people, you know, data is important. Data drives policy. So we really want people to be focusing on a strong surveillance program in your states, and we'll be looking at your grants that way. But I would say the STDMIS is a separate issue that only applies to maybe 15 states now that are still using STDMIS. From what I understand, it's like on its last, you know, it's on life support in the intensive care unit, and if it breaks, we're in trouble because we have no money to be building a new, you know, STDMIS system for those of you using it. So we want to work with you individually to help you transition to whatever system your state is using. We certainly want people to be integrating their STD surveillance into other electronic systems. A lot of people are using Maven. Some people are using PRISM. So whatever your communicable disease people are using at the state, we would like you to get STD case-based surveillance and case management integrated in that system. What we are going to be doing for those who are using the NEDS-based system, we are building a module that will be the equivalent of the STDMIS that will attach on to the people who are using a NEDS-based system. So this is something I think we're going to have to work out. You know, so we've got a team, at least at CDC, who are ready to help and provide technical assistance, and also get IT technical assistance if you need that with your systems. But we're hoping this transition is going to happen before this grant announcement comes out.
So I know we've got another session coming up. We have to be able to move the room around. So we're going to wrap it up in about 15 minutes. So I'll cut everybody off. Yeah, we'll talk fast. There's a question at the mic. And what questions we don't get to, Gail's here. I will personally hand them to her. So your questions will get addressed. And again, we're going to create, or I'm not we, I'm
maybe
you're
with,
you.
With NCSD, we'll do
with
a
frequently. With NCSD, a frequent,
oh, FQ, I think we're, yeah. We're going to do a frequently asked question.
Hi, Gail. Thanks. I just wanted to ask you about our current mandate to share our funding with our NGO Title X grantee partners, and whether you foresee any changes in that mandate coming up. I'd just like to state, at least in California, that is a real strength of the IPP program. I understand if the IPP is integrated into CSPS, that may be the direction of the future. But without that line item and that mandate, this past year, we would not have been able, our state would not have approved that transfer of money to our NGO partners, which allows us to have that direct connection to clinical agencies. They have the quality assurance skill set, the TA, the capacity building, and really more pragmatically, they have more contract flexibility than our state bureaucracies, and allowing us to do some really amazing work right out in the field. And so is the balance between having funding flexibility but also having line items that are specific that show our state bureaucracies that we have to do this.
Okay. So first of all, I've learned a few things since I've been at CDC. One is there is no mandate that we have to give half our money to, at least by the appropriation. Am I correct, Raul, on saying that? Yeah. So there is no mandate in the appropriations that we have to give half of the money to Title X agencies. There's also no mandate that says in CSPS you can't buy meds and reagents. So some people have said we can't buy azithromycin with our CSPS dollars. So those have been internal CDC decisions. So we have a lot of flexibility under the 318 to mandate however we want to mandate. But again, the challenge is how do we do it in a way for those who, you know, don't want to mandate, have a different idea of how they want to configure their program. How do we do it, you know, to do it in a way that kind of meets everybody's needs? So I think we're going to be looking at that. We certainly need to hear from people who feel having had this mandate, or perceived mandate, or at least from CDC, how that's been helpful to you, and if that's something we should, you know, continue in under the 318 authorization, if that's what we choose to use in this grant announcement.
Ralph Wilmoth from Colorado. I just have two comments. One is I really appreciate that you have indicated you're going to use a sexual health framework as part of your consideration for this announcement, and including reproductive health in your thought process about this. That's long overdue, and I think it will help us more effectively work with our partners in reproductive health services. And I would really, really appreciate it from a program perspective if when that FOA comes out on March 1st, it includes the description of the funding formula that's used in the announcement so we know what's coming on January 1st of 2014.
Okay.
Thanks.
There's a couple of questions I'm going to sort of bundle together. There's, again, I think there's a lot of anxiety about money, and some of it has to do with partner services. People are concerned, or there's some questions, is partner services being questioned or eliminated, in particular around syphilis? And if we're trying to do this around HIV, how are we sort of coordinating that? And then someone else had written that partner services may not work in high population areas the same way as they might in other areas, so should we be allowed to continue them in those areas that might be low morbidity?
You know, I think that, you know, I think partner services has been a core activity of STD control programs since we started doing STD control. And there's been a way we've been doing it with DIS, you know, field investigation is our, you know, Cadillac model of how we would like to offer partner services. I think partner services is still a core function of what we need to do, but I think locals really need to be looking at their data and saying, is this the most cost effective way for me to be getting partners served? We've already recognized that we don't have enough staff to follow up on chlamydia, so we haven't been having a lot of emphasis on DIS partner services for chlamydia, and some programs haven't really paid too close attention to GC either because they've only had enough DIS staff to really follow up on their syphilis cases. But I think that, you know, how people select partners, what they know about their partners, you know, one size doesn't fit all, and so I think we've really got to diversify and make sure that what we're doing is a cost-effective approach. It gets challenging in rural areas. Is it cost-effective to have someone drive for 8 hours to talk to one individual about the need for them to be treated a contact? You know, is there a more creative way we could do this through Facebook or internet or text messaging or something? I think we've got to start being creative about how we look at the way we do partner services. How many reactors are we going to go through to find somebody that maybe has infectious syphilis? Is that a cost-effective program? So I think we've been doing a lot of things, but I really want people to be looking at their data locally, and you have the permission now from CDC that if it's not working, try something else. And not just say, oh, you didn't interview very well, I want you to go back and re-interview that case again and find some more partners. You know, at some point we've got to be practical and be reasonable and look at it the way we're doing it. So we know in some areas, you know, gay men don't know who their partners are. They're into health care. They're highly educated. They know more about syphilis than their providers do, and they're much more interested in referring their partners that they know that they're going to continue in a relationship to the health department and don't want DIS services. So do we need to be calling them and offering the same kind of service that someone else who wants the health department's assistance in doing partner services? So I think we really need to be looking at how much resources are we putting into partner services, how effective is it, and do we need to be diversifying the work that we do, and there are other ways to get to the same goal, but with some other strategies.
There were a couple of questions that sort of bundled around the same issue. One of them has to do with the concern about losing DA positions and whether or not money would be included in the CSPS to supplement that loss. and what will be the base amount is the question specifically for DA levels.
Yeah.
And then sort of tied to that is a concern about funding for IT support.
Okay. Well, the DA situation is complicated because it's another example of where funding to the states and locals has gotten a little bit out of whack because I think with attrition, people have ended up staying in certain areas and then other areas didn't have replacements when people left. And there was also some confusion about were DA really part of your award or were they just kind of, you know, part of CDC's team that you had the luxury of having, you know, for as long as CDC decided that person was there. And I think I got different messages in California over the years about what my DA were. Were they really working for me or were they really there as a guest and I could use them as best as I could, but there was no guarantee that they would be filled if the position was vacated. And that's been the way that we've been operating, you know, when I came to the division was you've got this luxury, but there's no guarantee if somebody leaves that this position is going to be replaced. And I think that we've got to take the DA situation into our consideration of funding. What eventually I'd like to get to is that everybody has an allocation of funds. Okay? And that's your appropriation based on your base and your need. And then, if you decide in your area, you know, I have trouble filling a position, and this is something called Dr. Frieden's embedded model that he's trying to offer to all states who get federal funds. You know, if you decide for whatever reason you can't, you know, get that person through your state system, you can say, I'm going to give back this amount of cash to CDC, and I want you to hire me a DA person with this expertise that will be part of my state team. And that's what's called an embedded staff. So we'd like to get to that model so that you're investing in your DA and you're getting the staff that you need to fill the gaps that you might not be able to fill with your other staff. But we've also got, you know, our current DA structure that I think over time I strongly feel that we need people in the field that you know, can relate what's going on in the field to us in Atlanta. Atlanta's too far removed to understand all the issues. So we need some kind of field presence. But you guys also need staff to do your work because you're so underfunded. So we're trying as we move forward to come up with a balance of that, of, you know, who can be really staff that are working for you that just happen to be a federal staff person because you need that extra safety net support versus somebody that's out there who's trying to do more regional coordination and understand what's going on.
Okay, another quick hitter. What will happen to the annual progress report due the end of March?
Of this year?
Next year.
We still have to do annual progress reports. So that wasn't, this was only talking going forward with the 2014 FOA. So by law, by PGO law, you have to do interim progress reports and you have to do annual progress reports. So we still will have those same deadlines of when those are due as we move forward. And those will still be the same requirements when we have our new FOA out. I don't think those are changing at CDC.
Someone wanted to know, will there be anything in the RFP to address social determinants or how will that be addressed in there to be able to deal with that issue?
Well, it's something that we're all, I think, trying to find our roadmap. We all know that we've got health equity issues. The real question is how do we transform the concern and the disparities into some kind of action that can reduce disparities? And I don't think that roadmap is totally clear, but we will be working with the center because that's another one of the center's priorities of having all of the center grants deal with some level of social determinants of health. So whether or not it will be just be doing a better assessment in your surveillance and assessment area of social determinants of health, whether it's going to be assessing and then doing some program collaboration and integration to figure out how we might be able to address these issues collectively, not clear. So always interested in input of what we should be doing more in this area to reduce the health disparities that we see with STIs in the country.
So another thing which I think is palpable is a shift away from individual siloed disease approach to sort of community level approaches in sexual health. And so there are a couple of questions that talk about what is the future of IPP and gonorrhea, and the concern around that is losing focus. So if we're supposed to do this catch-all, will we lose specific control of these diseases and management?
Right. And I'm a believer, as Dr. Kern said yesterday, that we can't lose our disease-specific approaches, and we need to use our disease-specific approaches to be building our infrastructure. So First of all, we need to focus on gonorrhea probably more than we have. The problem is we don't have any more money, so the real question is what can we shift that maybe we've been doing for syphilis that hasn't been as effective that we can move over and start looking at, you know, what we can do in the area of gonorrhea. Maybe we need to do some more contact tracing, you know, and looking at sexual networks for gonorrhea to figure out what's going on in terms of these, you know, emerging strains with decreased susceptibility. There's another comment I wanted to make. Oh, about IPP. So I think some people have heard the rumor that IPP is going away. IPP is not going away. We really want to repurpose IPP. And if you understand the original intent of IPP, it was really to do STD screening, chlamydia and gonorrhea, in low-income settings, namely family planning and STD clinics. Well, we need to broaden IPP. We need to expand IPP. We really need to talk about infertility prevention. And if you heard, we need to be making sure that we're doing everything that we've been doing in family planning clinics in federally qualified health centers or school-based health centers. So IPP isn't going away. We're going to be repurposing. We're going to be, you know, capturing resources and billing where we can bill. And we're also going to be doing more assessment and assurance to ensure that the quality of service is being delivered at the settings where these women may be seen. We may need to help these settings understand how to do prevalence monitoring and design cost-effective screening programs. So I think we're going to be doing a little bit more in the area of quality assurance, working with broader partnerships. So I don't see them going away. I see us trying to do more with less, but hopefully that will have more impact on the number of women that we're trying to serve.
So I know we've got about a minute. I'm going to just ask one quick question. I would encourage you, if you have more cards, I'm going to literally hand these to Gail or to someone Gail designates to hold on to the cards. They'll get addressed, and again, there's going to be something developed around that, and this is a very simple question, which is what's going to happen to Sun funding in the future?
Okay. So I recognize that we don't have the resources like HIV does to have robust surveillance for all of our states and have separate surveillance grants. So I thought about that, but I really did the math, and that wasn't going to work. So I do believe that we need to continue Sun like we need to continue our prevention training centers. I look at our prevention training centers as centers of excellence that either provide clinical training to providers in the community or they provide partner services to people doing partner services activities in the community, and we need to be broadening our partner services training to internet partner services and other types of things that we want to look at. So I believe that we need to continue Sun. I believe that Sun is our centers of surveillance excellence. But I think how we do Sun, we're also getting input from our Sun colleagues and anyone else as to how Sun should be looking. I think Sun needs to be looking beyond asking questions in STD clinics. We might want to have Sun helping programs learn how to analyze managed care data, looking at more population-based approaches, regional approaches. And I think the challenge that I see with Sun is I think Sun, sometimes it was designed as a convenient surveillance system where we had STD clinics, so that we started saying, okay, I've got an STD clinic, what question can I answer here? I would like us to step back and say, what are the important surveillance questions we need to ask? And then figure out how are we going to do that? And that's where our centers of excellence will be doing that. And I also expect these centers of excellence to be working on a regional level to help build surveillance capacity at state and local levels that don't have a lot of capacity. And I also expect Sun sites, which I didn't realize, they have to be part of your state STD program. You cannot have your state STD surveillance program. You cannot have your Sun centers of excellence sitting over in a different part of your health department and then have your STD surveillance program not working with your Sun people. So to me, I do feel like, and you can give me input, I think it's very important that if we're going to be funding centers of excellence in STD surveillance, that they've got to be part of that state's or local surveillance program, that they're integrated so that we can also build capacity within the region that's getting the Sun grants.
So that's a wrap. we're going to all hose ourselves down afterwards. So I want to thank Gail again for her availability. There's a website, so if you have questions, you can funnel that in. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Okay. All right.